Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Pessimism never won any battles, said Dwight D. Eisenhower. Yes, that is true. That is true for Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was a warrior and a general. But what if you're an ordinary person? You can't be a pessimist? What's wrong with it? Arnold Bennett, a Victorian-era British author, said pessimism, when you get used to it, is just as agreeable as optimism. And I'll say something else for pessimism. If you're pessimistic long enough, you'll never be disappointed. That's a Savage original. Putting me into the lexicon on pessimism. Michael Savage, the great American author and commentator, said that if you're pessimistic long enough, you will never be disappointed. That's pretty good. I have a very dark sense of humor, to be honest with you. But it's worked for me my whole life. It has worked for me my entire life. The dark sense of humor that I have has gotten me through virtually everything so far. I can't have a false optimism like the how to win friends and influence people, which is, by the way, it is American, how to win friends and influence people. When I first heard that philosophy somewhere after my sufferings of young worth of phase, like 18, 19, it was so alien to me. I felt like I was from another planet. I tried to twist my brain into being optimistic, but I didn't know how to do it. I had no concept of how to be an optimist. I don't know how to be an optimist. Look at me. Listen to what I'm saying to you. I don't know if you're interested in this, but it's a very interesting topic. Pessimism is an equally valid way to get through life as is just as valid as optimism, right? And yet it's considered almost un-American or anti-American to be pessimistic. I know it is. Oh, look, he's too pessimistic. So? And? What's the difference? Some of the greatest poetry and music, you know, it reflects pessimism, melancholia. I can tell you right now, you listen to any piano concerto of another period, it's all pessimistic music. On the verge of suicide, every piano concerto was written by some genius composer who was this far away from knocking himself off. But he tore his heart out in composing the piano concerto. Very little of it is uplifting. Yeah, maybe he'll go into a few uplifting sections of his composition. So what do you want to talk about, optimism, pessimism? I would say that most people listen to talk radio are pessimists. That would be my guess. Mixed in would be some of the people who are lifetime optimists. God bless them how they do it. I don't know what it is. You have to always have a positive attitude, keep your head up. It works. I remember actually when I think about it, I was going through this phase a long time ago when I read a book by an optimist, a whole workbook that had all sorts of programs in the Bay Area on how to make you think differently and positively. It was so alien to me. But people at work, coworkers, had the books. And one of the statements, and it made sense, in order for an airplane to fly, the attitude of the plane has to be kept up. That got me through the University of California at Berkeley, the last year, the hardest year of my life. What I'm going through now is nothing compared to my PhD program. But I didn't run through a movie theater with a gun. I finished it out and got my PhD from Berkeley. I got it in 2.3 years, world record. You know, I don't know if anyone's got a PhD faster than I do from that great university. I came there with two master's degrees and six books to my name, two children, working a job, and I still got a PhD in 2.7 years. Would you believe it? 3.95 index out of a 4.0. You don't read about that because, oh, Michael Savage, Well, the fact is that I remember I had a job during that phase, too. I was working at some job, and the guy had the book where it said, an airplane, in order for it to maintain altitude, must keep its attitude up, meaning the nose had to be up in order to gather the wind. And it's the same with the person. So from that point on, I picked up a little optimism to fly through the program. It was really hard for me and bad. It was the worst. You know, the worst day of my life was in that PhD program. What I'm going through now is nothing compared to that. Never. I thought I would never make it through. You want to hear what pessimism? You want to hear depression? I wanted a PhD more than anything on the earth at the time. It was the number one thing in my life. It wasn't because I was told it was a union card and it would get me a teaching position, which I wanted very badly. It wasn't just that. It was the honor of a real PhD. I wanted it more than anything I had ever wanted in my life, right? So I was willing to do anything for it. Well, I had reached the point of the end of the road with, I think it was oral exams were coming up. You don't know what an oral exam is. It's as tough as anything you can go. Maybe a kid going through a parole hearing would understand what an oral exam is, because it was like being in a parole hearing. You have like a panel of your three professors, and you have to defend your thesis. And you really have to know your stuff, because they're going to cut you to ribbons if you're at a real university in a real science. Very tough. I remember feeling so low. This is hard to describe. I was sitting in the men's room, where men sit in men's rooms. I felt as though I had disappeared within my body and had fallen into the toilet. I know you can laugh at it. It sounds humorous, but it wasn't. It was almost a semi-psychotic state of exhaustion. Exhaustion, exhaustion, exhaustion. I used all of the techniques that I still use, frankly, to get through those periods, including religion. It's when I think I went into my very heavy God phase. The heavy God phase came after I got my PhD, and 65 universities rejected me because I was white and bright. They said, white, bright men need not apply. Don't even send us another one. Almost a 4.0 index, great PhD. Published at a major university, they didn't want to hire me because I was a white male. They were hiring, as you well know, anyone but white males at that time if they could. So I went into a very bad state, and I had to find the strength within to survive. Two young children, didn't know where the next dollar was going to come from, didn't know what to do with myself, all because the ACLU said some people in our society will have to put their lives on hold. And I was that person. Very personal story. So I got deeply into the religious at that time. I can't say I found God, because God never left me. I mean, I left God. You understand how that works? See, I didn't think I'd get into God talk, but here we are. God never left me. I turned my back on God. He never went anywhere. He was there all the time. I found a way back to tapping into that energy source, if you want to put it into a strict physical sense. Anyone who's into the physical sciences understand God in different terms than I do. Einstein, one of the world's greatest physicists, said that the longer he studied the perimeters of the universe, the more he came to realize there had to be a creator, God. You will never read that in your university books today, because they don't want you to think that Einstein was a God-believing man. They want you to think he was a wild atheist who stuck his tongue out so that you can, you know, use drugs and become a sexual degenerate and get your PhD from Harvard in degeneracy. Nevertheless, the point is that I did discover again some very deep powers. And I have to say right now I'm out of that phase. To my detriment, maybe I have to do it again. There are methods, there are techniques to find God. It's not easy, by the way, to talk to God. You may say it is, it isn't. It is very difficult to communicate with God. There are those who believe, oh yeah, you just got to accept God, he's there, turn around. Wrong. Wrong. You could do the mumbo jumbo version of it. Yeah, and you can go through the sitting in the pew and mumbling and reading the book, and you're not going to feel a thing. And that's why many of you go in and come out and say, who needs it? There's nothing there. You listen to another boring sermon. You don't feel God. You look at the stained glass, you look at the cross, and you feel nothing. Or if you're Jewish, you go in and you hear the mumbo jumbo in Hebrew, you don't understand half a word that they're saying. Or if it's in English, it's even worse. You know, the Reform synagogues look like churches without crosses to most Jews. They don't know what to make of it. They come out with no uplifting of their spirit. It's very hard to see God. It's not easy. You know, don't fool yourself. All these books that tell you, oh yeah, God's waiting for you. He may be, but he's not an easy guy to reach. You know, he's really busy. He's got a lot of things to do, and it's not easy to get through to him. You really got to know his number one. You got to know what number to call, exactly how to dial, and you got to make sure he's in when you ring him. I'll be right back. Savage. I know it's a shock to hear the word pessimism. It's probably some kind of crime against bullying or something. I don't know if you're allowed to say you're a pessimist. It could be anti-American. But the thing is, some brilliant people have written some great things. Here's Mark Twain who said, the man who is a pessimist before age 48 knows too much. If he is an optimist after it, he knows too little. Robert Oppenheimer, you know, the father of the H-bomb, he said, the optimist thinks that this is the best of all possible worlds. The pessimist knows it. That's interesting. Now, Arthur Schopenhauer is my kind of philosopher. Listen to this one. Takes a little thinking. There is not much to be got anywhere in the world. It is filled with misery and pain. If a man escapes these, boredom lies in wait for him at every corner. More even, it is evil which generally has the upper hand, and folly that makes the most noise. Fate is cruel and mankind pitiable. Arthur Schopenhauer. Now, Fyodor Dostoevsky, for those of you who remember him, I doubt that you remember him in this day and age where people Twitter. I grew up on Tolstoy. I steeped myself in Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. But Dostoevsky, one of the great Russian writers, wrote, I renounce the higher harmony altogether. It's not worth the tears of that one tortured child who prayed with unexpiated tears to dear, kind God. Very, very, very interesting. I know a lot of people feel that way. How can there be a God when a child is being tortured? Well, my only answer to it is that God is not omnipotent. God is omnipresent. We've had this discussion before. Because if you don't accept, if you can't balance that out, then there's no point in believing in anything. You have to believe that there's a God in heaven, but he doesn't control your free will. You have free will. The lunatic has free will to be a lunatic and kill people. That's like sitting in your house and an airplane engine falls through your roof and kills you. It's like, how do you get up in the morning with a thing like that? Well, that's who lives like that? I don't live with that kind of things in my mind, you know. I mean, I do believe that there's some kind of balance in nature. I'll give you an example. I'm a nature lover. I'm very kind to animals. But I have a problem. I have seagulls on my roof, and they've had seagull eggs that hatched into seagull babies. They're driving me insane. 4 in the morning, and they're crapping everywhere. I can't stand it anymore. I used to give them a bagel. Look what they became. So there's too many of them. I don't know what to do. So I got a bunch of pebbles on my deck. And this morning, finally, I threw one at the big seagull. It was on my chimney. I didn't hit it. I threw it near it, and it flew away. Didn't like it. I saw it looked at me with anger. Like, oh, okay, I'll show you. About a half hour later, I'm slicing a bagel with a brand new bread knife. I cut my finger again. The same Nazi knife did it again. Remember I bought that new bread knife last week and I cut my hand in the store? Again, I cut now another finger with it. I couldn't stop the bleeding for 2 hours. But the point is, look at the cut now. It's healed up. I said, wait a minute. Maybe God said to you, stop throwing pebbles at seagulls. I don't know. Who knows? Call PETA on me. What do you want from me? Okay, leave me alone already. They get into their Lexus and drive to an anti-American meeting. Gorilla in zoo hangs himself. I wasn't depressed enough. I have to read this. That's impossible. A gorilla can't hang himself. Oh, hang accidentally. Thank God. Accidentally hanging himself with a climbing rope. I couldn't believe a gorilla would do that. Animals don't commit suicide. I mean, they do, actually. Animals do commit suicide. Like the killer whales that wash up on shore. Another gorilla comb appeared to be trying to help Tatu when zookeepers arrived, but it's hard to say what exactly she was doing. Oh, this is awful. I know why I'm depressed today. I really do. Are there any pessimists out there who are enjoying today's show that would make you not pessimistic? See, that's the problem. If you're a pessimist, you're probably enjoying this show, which means I'm making you feel good, which is not a good thing for you. You're liable to blow your philosophy. And it's also because I'm traveling and the thought of leaving my pants. Remember I told you that earlier? I'm traveling, so I have to go through every closet now. All these pants are sitting there. I have to select only a few and leave the others behind, the shirts, the belts, the ties, which I never wear anyway. But the thought of not taking them with me bothers me. Selecting which shoes to take, which personal effects to leave behind and whatnot. Then the dog can't come. It's too hot for him in Florida. So I got to leave him. And the thought of not having him at night, playing with him, talking to him. I mean, I drive with the dog. The guy's in my car with me all the time. I'm never lonely with the dog next to me. I swear to God, I'm never alone. Like he does such cute things like my little. Like if I go fast, which I do very often in my big S600, I call it Wilhelm, this powerful monster car. I love when he leans back against the front seat. He sits in the right seat and he sees if I'm gonna like I get mad at someone on the highway, I want to go around them, or I'm on a curvy road and I'm speeding, whatever. He balances himself up against the seat, like with one leg. He pushes back. He leans back. It's such a cute thing to have a dog that you love. Really, it is. It's amazing. And then you start talking to him, and he looks at you. Yeah, look, I know. You start to think he actually knows what you're saying. Nah, look, it's bad. I understand. Don't worry. But he has emotions. He has emotions. Like if I pull up to a certain house that I go to, and we're going to see people we love, he starts to kiss me in the ear. He gets excited. He kisses me in my right ear, and he's normally very aloof. Other dogs, if you ask them to do something, idiots, their tongues hanging out. You ask a golden retriever to do anything, it's like,
anything you want.
You know, but you ask a poodle, it's like, I don't know, I'll think about it, I'll get back to you. I'm not too sure, I'm busy right now. They're very aloof creatures, like in another world. He's sort of like that, but he's a toy poodle, so he's not totally like that, because if he gets me mad, I pick him up like a pocketbook. He's not like 120. He's not like an 85-pound poodle. If he gets me mad and I ask him a question, he doesn't answer me fast enough, I pick him up like a pocketbook and carry him. That's the end of it. All right, let's just go. It's not like you want to go. It's like people who raise their children wrong. You ever see him talk to a three-year-old? Bobby, would you like the soy milk or would you like the carrot frappe? The kid looks at him like he's crazy. They think the child understands most. It doesn't understand. Or the people in restaurants who bring coloring books. I leave. I move tables or I leave the restaurant. I pay the check and go. I cannot eat dinner next to a child coloring. I don't go to a restaurant for ding-dong school. I am sorry. And I had children young. There's a limit. I had a friend at those times. I dumped him a long time ago. He became a pot-headed doctor. Never saw him again. He went into medicine to steal the medicine out of the cabinets. Never heard from him again. I wish him well. I don't know what he looks like. He probably looks like Methuselah from all the drugs he stole out of the clinic. He took his child when they were young to a restaurant, and she would change a diaper. While you're eating dinner, I swear to God, she'd put the child on the table, open up the diaper, make you look at it and change it. Hippies from Berkeley they were at the time. I hear they're big Obama supporters today. I swear to God, absolutely true. A diaper they would change on a table. Could you put up with this?
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
So you go to a restaurant, and there's a lot of older guys with young babies. I understand that. I can understand it because it's an, but you're going to, what's with the training in a restaurant? I love the ones who try to show you how smart their child is. You're trying to have a romantic dinner or even just get through without gagging. Never mind romantic. How about one meal without somebody driving you insane by talking about politics or screaming after a glass of wine? The women get gassed up in Marin County. I don't know what they're on. It's like laughing gas. One glass of wine, they're already gassed out of their mind, and they start screeching. You can't believe it. You can't eat. It's like chalk on a blackboard. I order the check. I'm out of there. Pack it up. Put it in the box. I'm going home. That's it. I'm gone. If you get too loud a group, two glasses of white wine, bad cheap white wine, $12 a glass, and they're already flying high. You mix that with whatever the doctor put them on, and you're out of control. I mean, that's the thing. Now you mix that, it's unbelievable. What a mixture. But the worst thing of a restaurant for me, the worst, is the trainers, the child educators in the restaurant. Everyone tries to show you how smart their child is, and they have history lessons in the restaurant. And so, Billy, let's pick up a topic. Anything like, when exactly in the year 1776 did George Washington, and the kid answers him, like a whole question and answer. Mm-hmm. They have questions for the child over dinner. You're trying to dine in an adult restaurant. Now, of course, they can't ban children from restaurants. They get a lawsuit. I understand that. It's a very sensitive issue. Can they not have a special time for adults, let's say over the age of 40, where children, or put them in a separate room? Or is that like against children? Why must you mix? You can't mix certain age groups. It's impossible. You cannot. It's just a different world. It's a different speed. Just a different speed. You don't want to hear about George Washington crossing the Delaware or what year the Constitution was written in or anything of that nature. When was the Grand Coulee Dam built, Bob? And the kid knows the answer.
The Grand Coulee Dam was built.
And you have to listen to this. It's awful. They sound like Barney Frank on laughing gas, most children. I don't want to listen to them. 1-800-449-8255. Don't call the phone number about that. Instead, what I want to do is talk about spanking. Because I believe that children certainly are being raised too soft. I myself was not spanked. My father never, ever hit me in his entire life. So far as I, never. I was raised in a rough way, but it was verbal, mental. He kept me in line verbally and mentally, but he never spanked me. But there's an article out today from a child psychiatrist which says spanking ups risk of mental disorders, which I don't agree with, incidentally. And they asked the question, which was just published, which is, as a child, how often were you ever pushed, grabbed, shoved, slapped, or hit by your parents or any adult living in your house? Spanking or physical punishment for disciplinary purposes is often described as controversial. Yet some ethnic groups and some people from the old school believe sparing the rod could lead to spoiling the child. Do you know that some ethnic groups actually pride themselves on spanking and hitting their child? Did you know that physical punishment, now this is according to this article, don't blame me, physical punishment is more culturally acceptable in some African, Middle Eastern, and Asian households. And in some Asian schools in particular, corporal punishment has been described to be deeply ingrained in Confucian culture. Compared with being white, black individuals had increased odds of harsh physical punishment, whereas Asian, Native Hawaiian, and other Pacific Islander respondents had decreased odds of experiencing harsh physical punishment. So they say that there's a greater risk of developing mental health problems in the absence of child maltreatment. But if you got spanked, you're liable to be physically hurt by it. I certainly take my hat off to those who discipline their children without hitting them. I'm not so sure that anger is the answer, though. I don't see how you can be a parent without getting angry at some point. There's no question that children today are soft and coddled and could certainly benefit from tougher parenting. But getting tougher or disciplined doesn't need to include getting spanked or paddled, in my opinion. I didn't get hit by my father, even though he was from the old world. I got verbally tongue-lashed constantly, and I can't say that I enjoyed it. In fact, I hated it. In fact, I still have scars from it to this day, but so what? So what? Look at African cultures in Africa. Look at the boys who have physical scars in their bodies from various rituals they had to go through in order to prove they were a man. So in my case, my father gave me mental scars for me to become a tough man. People would say he was overly harsh. It's hard to say. I didn't raise my children that way, although I'm sure I missed the mark from their point of view. I did this type of show once before in my history, 18 years in radio. About 3-4 years ago, I did it. I could not believe the calls I got. The argument is that push, grab, shove, slapped, or hit by your parents will often screw up a child. And I agree. I think it's horrible. I don't like seeing a kid hit. On the other hand, there are people who believe in corporal punishment, particularly from Asian, Middle Eastern households, African, some Asian schools, in fact, they use corporal punishment. Caning is an official form of school discipline in Singapore. And, we don't understand that children cannot be let to do everything they want to do. Doesn't mean you hit them, but you have to control them. Children are fundamentally like wild animals, and they need, don't you? You don't know that? I mean, that's the first thing you do is teach a child, not to mess the floor, go to the potty. It's called potty training. Liberals, you'd have trouble with potty training. They think that they're damaging the child by telling him not to do it in the road. And now look around the society. These are millions of undisciplined children running around with iPhones. All they want to do is have sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Day and night. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. They think that explains the reason for human evolution. So what I'm saying is, where is the discipline? How are you disciplined? Now, I never spanked my children, but they did a study. As a child, how often would you ever push, grab, shove, slapped, or hit by your parents or any adult living in your house? Here it's called child abuse, but in certain households, particularly ethnic households of certain kinds, they use physical punishment regularly. For better or for worse, culturally acceptable. Asian, Middle Eastern, African. Corporal punishment described as deeply ingrained in Confucian culture. Caning used in Singapore. So the question is, how do you provide healthy limits and such on children without hurting them? How do you shape their behavior? How do you shape their behavior when they're running around with an iPhone and they're all id, to use a Freudian phrase that is lost on the masses today. The child today has no superego. It's all id. It's impulse. If it feels good, do it. All they want to do is get stoned or drunk and have sex. You say not a bad idea, but it's not a joke. That's why we have so many tens of millions of people who are ignoramuses. They come out of college. College. I went to college. They can't add. They cannot write cursively. They can't do anything, and yet they get mad when they take their first job because it's a lowly job. It's all they're fit for. And so, therefore, it's all based upon the fact that we have a permissive culture. As you know, China is still a very, very highly disciplined society, and look how well they're doing. Take a look at what we're teaching our children today. A local high school in Marin County just spent millions of dollars not to build a new computer lab, not to build the most advanced science laboratories, but to build a theater so more of the jerks could put on tights and be thespians. That gives you some idea of the mental thinking here in the San Francisco Bay Area, that the child should be an actor, run around in tights. Nothing wrong with being an actor, but a society can only use so many actors, right? There's only so many actors that you can use. Where are we supposed to get all of the trained, technically advanced, scientifically knowledgeable individuals? I guess we can bring them in from India and China and give them B-1B visas. Huh? Is that what you want? A nation of imbeciles. So is discipline related to imbecility, or a lack of discipline related to imbecility? That is the question. It really turns around on that question. Is discipline related to social imbecility, or the lack of discipline related to social imbecility? That is the question. You know, it's interesting. Spare the rod and spoil the child. I never used the rod because I didn't want to traumatize my children. They don't like me anyway. So you see, you can't win anyway. They still have. Here's the thing you got to understand as a parent: no matter what you do, they're not going to like you. Symbol shot. It's a simple theorem. No matter how you raise the child, at least one out of two is not going to like you. If you're lucky, it's one out of two. They'll say you were this, you were that, you didn't do this, you didn't do that, you looked at me the wrong way, you weren't there at the soccer game, and I needed you at that particular second. You may have been in the hospital, but they only see that you weren't at the soccer game because they think you're God, you're all-knowing, and that you should be able to, you know, take care of their every emotional need. That's the way it is. Parents are gods to children, and as gods, we fail them. Just as God fails us, I know now we're shifting into the theology, just as God fails man, because man wants more from God than he's able to give each of us, parents will fail children. So you can't take it personally. You have to understand that you're not going to be a perfect parent. And the parent who tries too hard to be the child's friend is really not doing that child a favor. I don't say be their enemy, but you know, you got to be a parent. I don't go for the man running around with the shorts and the ball 24/7 where he's his son's best friend. The son needs a father. He has friends from school. Try not to be his best friend. Try to be his father. That's harder. It's much harder to be his father than it is to be his best friend. And that's why so many men today think that just playing ball with the kid is enough. I'm not saying it's bad. It's a nice thing to do. But then they need you to discipline them. The homework, whatever, okay? It's a hard job. The hardest job on earth being a father. The second hardest, well, I would say it's as hard as being a mother. I don't know. The mother has it much harder. I think the mother today has it much harder than the father. Traditionally, it's been true anyway. The women bear more pain than men do. You gotta have pity for women. I know they don't want to hear it, but truthfully, the woman bears so much pain. And all you got to do is look at the biology of it. I mean, giving birth has to be one of the most painful experiences a human being can go through. And yet women do it. Women can handle it. Men could probably not handle that level of pain. Women are actually made to bear that pain, would you believe it or not. Men couldn't handle it. It's a different sort of thing that men are made to bear than that type of physical pain. And so women are by inherent nature, they're stronger than men, which is why they outlive us. Women, the weaker sex, the kinder sex. It's not true. The women are tougher. Biologically, they're tougher because they have to bear children. And to bear a child requires tremendous physical strength. And that physical strength carries over into older age.
Savage.
I am one man alone. I have no organization. I have no headquarters. I have no office. My office is a telephone booth, so to speak. My office is a cell phone and a computer. I have no network, none whatsoever. I'm a man alone. So how do I reach so many people? How do I reach so many people? Why do you listen? You've got 50, 70 radio stations in most metropolitan markets. You've got the unlimited internet access, newspapers, books. Why would you take the time out to listen to me? You have to understand, I ask myself this every day when I get up. Like, why the heck would they listen to me? I mean, I'm telling you my view of the world. And I'm not asking you to call and tell me, Mike, I'm listening because blah, blah, blah. I don't want you to call on that. Because I pretty much know the answer to the question. I'm posing the question for another reason. And I don't have a conclusion to what I just said. All I can say to you is that this is a very difficult business. It's a very difficult time. I've been immersed in a lawsuit for my honor. And here it is. It just shows you how life is. But you have to take it the way it comes. You get the cards dealt at you, and you play the hand. That's all there is to it. So at a certain point, you have to ask yourself, you know, what it's all about. What's your legacy? Does a legacy matter? There are no legacies anymore. That's another thing I have to tell you. When I grew up, a legacy mattered. I remember when I was 18 and struggling to figure it all out, I remember writing some blathering poetry or whatever, and then I wrote in my journal at the time that the mark a man leaves at his death is what he writes, you know, in that case, because I was a writer. But no one cares who the guy was who wrote what. The world changed with the advent of the internet and the computer. The whole world changed because there is no yesterday. There's not even a tomorrow. There's only now. There's not even a today. There's only a now. There's not even yesterday. There's not even an hour ago. There's only now. So what does a legacy mean? Do you really care what a man wrote, his body of work? Are you kidding me? There was a time in Jewish history when a man was buried with the books he wrote. Did you know that? You didn't know that. Books? Are you kidding me? Does anyone even know what the man did? Does anyone care what the man did? Does anyone care what the man stood up for? Does anyone care what the man stood up for in the battlegrounds of Iraq, or the CIA men who stood up and died for this country, who are now being attacked by the Obama administration? Men who gave their lives for this country to keep us safe from the communist bastards who want to turn us into slaves are now being prosecuted by Eric Holder. Does that not register in your mind as to tell you where we are living and how? I say to myself every day as I get up, no, it doesn't matter at all. The whole world is upside down.
Savage.
My dad had a little antique store next to it. It was a funeral parlor, right? So as a kid in those days, you could play on the street without getting killed or raped because all the men were out there watching the kid. And if anyone looked at you wrong, they would either have the guy thrown down into a basement or they'd call a cop who would give him a beating like he never had in his life with a nightstick, and the pervert would never come around to the neighborhood again. But those were those days. Anyway, I go in the funeral parlor as a kid, and they'd let me drive the hearse and this car and the flower car. But those garages stank, you know what I mean? I mean, the fumes. How did the men even survive in those days? The reek that came out of those cars in the 60s, 50s, 60s. They had a passageway onto the elevator. I mean, the garage must have been built in the 20s or the 30s. Now you're talking the 50s, 60s. The cars were wider, right? It was less than a quarter of an inch clearance to pull it into one of those Godfather elevators, you know, like where they pull a strap and you pull a car in and they pull a strap and the door comes down. And the elevator had a certain sound. It was like, mmm. They threw like the wheel they would turn. It was a different sound in the elevator, smooth, like an Electroglide in Blue elevator, you know, that took you right up. If you pressed the wrong way on the thing, it took you down into the mortuary where they did the embalming. I really didn't want to go down there once. I did go down there once. Remember I told you I went in the mortuary? Remember I told you that story? So one hot summer day on Ludlow Street in my father's market, I'm fishing around for those Coca-Cola bottles in an ice box. There was not a refrigerator outside. They actually had ice, and they had the water would turn so cold that when you fished for the, you'd roll up your undershirt, and you'd stick your arm in, and you'd fish around for a soda. And the water was so cold, your arm turned blue by the time you found the soda. Actually, the last I saw that portrayed in the movies was in Carlito's Way, where the guy reaches for the soda and gets knocked off. So anyway, I got my arm in the thing. I'm fishing out the soda. That, I'm giving you the picture, the background. And my father goes back in his store. To this day, you know, having dreams, I'm back in the store with him over and over again. Maybe I'm, I don't know, I don't want to get into it. I don't want to get into this whole maudlin thing, but I think I'm dreaming too much about him and the store. It means like I'm about to, you know, take the walk. I don't know. It's not good. These dreams are not good. If you start dreaming too much about that, it means that you're close to, you know what I mean? So I don't really like it, but I don't control the subconscious. So anyway, he goes back in the store, and I think the guy's name was Louie from the funeral parlor. He says, hey, kid, you want to come in here and take a look around? Yeah, yeah, I'll go in. I go in there. He says, have you ever seen a stiff? I said, no. He said, you want to see a stiff? Now, he wasn't, we're not talking pervert here, okay? He meant corpse. We're not talking about, you know what I'm saying, the teachers of today. So he says, all right, the elevator, down, pulls the strap. Instead of going up into the garage, down into the thing. And there, and I see, and there's the stiff, and the autopsy, the boy cut open, and they're horrible, like a chicken farm. So now I come up from whatever they call it. And that's not an autopsy. An autopsy's in the hospital, right? This is an embalming. Horrible, disgusting thing. I come up, I'm 11 years old. There must have been a change in my eyes because my father was on the street looking for me. Michael, where are, and he sees me come out of there. And he looks in my eyes. You know, a father can see it. He sees a change in me. He says, where were you? I said, I was in there with Louie. He said, well, what'd you do in there? I said, I went downstairs. And what'd you do downstairs? I told him. Well, I don't think he ever liked Louie again after that.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Welcome to the Savage Nation. Let him hear that. Would you play it a little? Wake him up out there. Wake up the living dead. Wake up the walking dead out there in America. Hollow men. The empty skirts. The empty suits. The robots. The welfare recipients. The food stamp eaters. I am talking to the 50% of America, meaning you, those of you who work for a living and support the other 50% who are being carried on your backs like a monkey on your back. Welcome to the Savage Nation. Today we're going to talk about violence coming from the sewer pipe of Hollywood. We are going to continue talking about the violence and pornography that is spewing out of the sewer pipe of Hollywood to the world, which has triggered the Islamic revolution around the globe. I don't care what anyone says. It's a reaction to the sewer pipe of Hollywood. You could say it's our foreign policy with regard to Israel, but it doesn't explain the Islamic violence in Indonesia. It doesn't explain the Islamic violence in all of those other hot points around the world. No, it doesn't. You can blame the Jews all you want, but I'm going to say that most of the Islamic hatred for the West is not about Christianity per se. It's about the culture. What do you mean the culture? The pornography and the violence that is being created disseminated through the sewer pipe of Hollywood. And so I want to talk again today about this issue because somebody has to knock their heads together. Somebody has to take Katzenberg, Ratzenberger, Matzenberg, and bang their heads together and say, the party is over, Bubala. It's time for you to understand that the world is not going to take your vile garbage anymore. I don't care if you created the presidency. You're not gods. You're not Caesars. So I'm going to read for you the Motion Picture Production Code, which was the industry moral censorship guidelines that governed the production of most U.S. pictures released by major studios between 1930 and 1968. It was known as the Hays Code, named after Hollywood's chief censor of the time, Will H. Hays. And so people followed this code. I told you I grew up in a time when my father said certain things were never allowed to be shown in movies, but you don't know why. Well, there was a code. And that code was thrown out around the same time that Allen Ginsberg, William Kunstler, and other of the most despicable human beings appeared on the planet, meaning on the social scene. 1968, when marijuana made its way into the mainstream, and when left-wing fanaticism threatened to tear down civilization itself, they tore down any restraints upon Hollywood, and the rest is history. The production code spelled out what was acceptable and what was unacceptable content for motion pictures produced for public audience in the U.S. So what was not allowed to appear in movies? What was not allowed to appear in movies up until 1968 when William Kunstler, Allen Ginsberg, I can name a few others who destroyed Western civilization, shook the pillars of civilization and almost destroyed us. I don't know that we've survived, frankly. Among the things that were not allowed to appear in movies, you're listening to The Savage Nation, were the following. Pointed profanity, suggestive nudity, the illegal traffic in drugs, children's sex organs, ridicule of the clergy. Let's pause right there. Do you know of one movie that's called a drama today or action that does not have profanity, nudity, drugs, children half naked, or a ridicule of the Catholic Church? I don't know of one. Ask Katzenberg, Hatzenberg, Matzenberg, and Ratzenberg why they continue to make such vile filth. Let me go on. Among the things that required special care, according to the Motion Picture Production Code, when dealt with in the movies were the following. The use of the American flag. Jeffrey, the use of the American flag, the thing that has given you your fame and fortune, Mr. Katzenberg, the thing that you spit upon, in my opinion. Arson, the use of firearms, theft, robbery, safe-cracking, dynamiting of trains, mines, and buildings. Couldn't show them in the movies. Brutality and possible gruesomeness. Ha! Oh, Marty Scorsese, where would you be without this? Martin Scorsese, the great genius, old Marty. Everyone refers to him as Marty on a first-name basis because he's such a nice guy. Or Robert De Niro or Sean Penn. Nice liberals. They're all psychotic left-wingers, aren't they? So let me interject this. Which actors and directors, aside from Sean Penn, in your opinion, are most guilty of violence, which they then cover up with their excessive liberalism? It's an old game. You make your living showing extreme violence. You make your fortune that way, and then you pretend you're a liberal. You go to Haiti and you, I don't know what you do in Haiti. I have no idea what he did down there. No one does. Or you towed a machine gun in Louisiana after the Hurricane Katrina to show you're a tough guy in life as you are in the movies. So which actors, aside from the despicable Sean Penn, in your opinion, are most guilty of violence, which they then cover up with their extreme liberalism? So let me go on now with the other things that required special care when dealt with in movies while Katzenberg, Hatzenberg, Matzenberg, and Ratzenberg were still wild-eyed, woolly-eyed hippies and not yet making movies. The use of the American flag, arson, the use of firearms, theft, robbery, safe-cracking, dynamiting of trains, mines, buildings, brutality, gruesomeness. Technique of committing murder, Jeffrey, by whatever method. Technique of committing murder, Mr. Spielberg. Sympathy for criminals, Mr. Spielberg. Sedition, Mr. Scorsese, Spielberg, Katzenberg, Hatzenberg, Ratzenberg. Apparent cruelty to children and animals. The sale of women or of a woman selling her virtue. A woman selling her virtue. A woman selling her virtue. Don't they all do it? Can you name one Hollywood slut who's actually married, who's had a baby in the last year? I love, they're a mom. Don't you love they're a mom? Don't you love that they're all moms walking around with their baby now, like the baby with odd names, no American names, of course. Names such as Hermes or scarf or handbag or shoe or nail polish. Here's my little daughter named Nail Polish. Here's my other baby named Diamond Ring. Here is my baby named Gucci. Here is my baby named Poochie. Wait until Poochie becomes a man. You'll really see something. No husbands, but they're all moms. Suddenly they want to cash in on the image of mom and apple pie. You couldn't show rape or attempted rape. Or you could do it, but you had to do it in a special way. Deliberate seduction of girls, Jeffrey. The institution of marriage could not be assailed and ridiculed, Jeffrey. The use of drugs, Alec. Titles or scenes having to do with law enforcement or law enforcing officers. You had to treat them delicately. You couldn't turn every cop into a criminal and every degenerate bum into a hero, Jeffrey. I've just read to you the motion picture production code. That was a set of standards all followed by the major studios between 1930 and 1968. Tell me what the standards are today. Tell me what the standards are today. Or call me with which actors other than the despicable fraud Sean Penn, in your opinion, are most guilty of violence, which they then try to cover up with extreme fraudulent liberalism.
Savage.
This is the Savage Nation. Is it amazing when you travel like the week later? Did you ever analyze time? Like, okay, let's say you're 50. Let's pick another age. You're 40. So you look back 20 years in your life at 40. I'm going to pick 40. And you say 20 years ago, like about 20 years ago when I was 20, but then you go forward. You say in 20 years, I'll be 60. Oh, I forget it. And you blank it out. You might, you don't even want to think about what you'll be at 60. You envision feeble. You envision holding your back, you're bald, you look like a combination of, who can I pick, like a bad image of a 60-year-old? A combination of Nick Nolte and Woody Allen combined. Imagine if you're 40 and healthy, you envision if by the time you're 60, you're gonna feel like Woody Allen and you're going to look like Nick Nolte at 60, basically an enfeebled old man. Do you know what I'm getting at? So the same thing is like travel. Okay, so last week I was in New York. So it's a week later. It seems like an eternity. So like Sunday night we arrived. I went to around downtown to my father's store with a camera. It was sufferingly hot, disgusting. The garbage stank. Monday was an open day. And everything to me is where I ate because there are only three nights. I remember Sunday night, I don't know where did I eat? Oh, a Sunday night we ate on our own. Horrible. Bad Italian restaurant, Midtown. Nondescript. Terrible. Monday night on our own, went out with my friend. He took us to a Persian restaurant on 2nd Avenue from Hunger. Garbage. The worst. The worst. I remember it by food. Tuesday night already was good. I went out with my publisher. Took me to a good Italian restaurant. We had a lot of fun. Terrific meal. Wednesday, the air incident. Incidentally, it was a turkey sandwich with no needles in it when the oxygen masks came down and the plane descended 10,000 feet. And I pulled out the prayer card. See, it was then a week later. Here we are. I think I need to travel more to have this perspective of where was I last Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. It does help the time go by. I think I'll go somewhere this weekend. I got to fly somewhere this weekend. I really see now the reason people travel. And it's wonderful the thought you could eat a turkey sandwich on Delta with a sewing needle in it dipped in HIV virus. What the heck? What an exciting trip that must be. While they're frisking grandmothers and nuns at the airport and letting people with turbans put needles into your sandwiches in Amsterdam. That's good. That's a good thing. You don't want to use any racial profiling, except in reverse. You want to make certain that you only frisk nuns. You want to make certain that you break old people and little children with who are crippled in wheelchairs.
Savage.
So I gave you like 11 questions, and I'm getting basically the people who receive radio on their filling calling. No, I'm not. I'm starting to wonder who listens to talk radio anymore. I don't even know. The business is so hard to predict. You don't know anymore. I mean, I'm starting to wonder about this. I have no idea who is listening.
Like, what are your favorite news websites other than my Michael Savage? Which types sites have you stopped going to and why? Do you still read a physical newspaper? When you buy a book, you're going to buy a hardcover or an ebook version of Trickle Down Tyranny next week for me. What are you going to do? Ann Arbor, Michigan. Mike, you're the first up. Go ahead, please. The land of the liberal.
What an honor. Well, you know, we're not all liberals out here, though. We have to fight the fight just like you every day. And simple, hard.
Mike, I love your call, but I can't hear you. You're echoing. So please, let's go to a non-speaker phone. Thank you for the call. That was really not from Ann Arbor. It was from Pelican Bay, I think. They give him one call a day in the rec room.
Mark, I got to tell you something. We bought one of those telephone booths after they went out of business. You know, we got it at an auction gallery. And we had a grandmother who really liked her phone. You know, we heard of the iPhone, where she said she had a phone, and she said, it's my phone, because I'm always on it, and that's why I say it's an iPhone, because it's my phone. Anyway, the point is, we bought that phone booth, and Mike, we buried her in that phone booth. She loved her phone so much, that old dial phone, we just buried her in that booth. I'm starting to think that's who listens to the show. I have no idea anymore. How can anybody in the world tell me they're interested in the utterances of Mitt Romney, Barack Obama, Newt Gingrich, Rick Santorum, and Neuron? Neuron's gone altogether. I think he went to the moon. Where is Neuron? He's completely off the canvas since I called him Neuron. Now I'm going to get slammed by the Ron Paul, but don't take it the wrong way. Please. You want to talk more about the race baiters, the haters, the race haters, the race baiters? Do you want me to talk about that? Well, I mean, what do you want me to talk about? Food again? A meatball? I can't do it. No meatball. I had a pizza last night. It's so bad for me. But why does it taste so good? I had a doctor friend he was one of the most advanced people in the world in nutrition and health, way before everybody. Real medical doctor, Stanford MD. And he went into nutrition in 1970. He knew more than most of the quacks today who know nothing. And Bob Cathcart, great man, great friend of mine. I loved him. Sorry he's dead. Really miss him. He said to me that we are addicted to that which we are allergic to, which is true, actually, when you think about it. You look at everything that you're addicted to, whether it's food or drugs, you could say you're allergic to the very thing you're addicted to. Even in people, you want to really push that metaphor. The things we are addicted to are that which we are allergic to. So what are you going to do? You know, it's like a sign I saw in my father's store when I was 5 years old. You remember the little signs that I used to have in those days? Everything alike is illegal, immoral, or fattening. Well, it's true. Nothing's changed. Because in my life, the same is true than it was then, because it's a universal truth. Isn't it true in your life, everything you like is illegal, immoral, or fattening? Except the Savage Nation, which is very interesting because this sort of sounds like it's a Samizdat news show in the ex-Soviet Union, which you're not allowed to listen to. It still has that quality, doesn't it? I still sound like I'm an underground guy, underground radio. Do you still like the show? Does anyone like the show? Yes or no? Well, why don't you tell me you love the show? Buddy needs to hear it every once in a while. Okay, Pittsburgh. Charlene, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yes, I do love your show. And to answer your question regarding whether or not I still read the newspaper, no, I listen to you. You go over all the important topics.
Well, that's interesting.
So
but remember, now, this is important to remember, to give credit where credit is due. I don't do investigative reporting. I don't do any reporting. I aggregate stories, and I pick the ones that are of interest to me, you know?
Interesting to me also, the important ones.
All right. Well, I do think that some of the ones I pick are important. I mean, talking about Subway sandwiches, cutting out the $5 sandwich because the minimum wage is too high here, I wouldn't rank that as one of the most important news stories of the day, would you?
No, but you interlace your stories with humor, and I need that too.
Well, that's a different story. I'm going to interlace your day with a copy of Trickle Down Tyranny. I don't even have the strength to ask you to give the title out. I'm so exhausted. But you know what I mean? I was normally making people answer it.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
I got to tell you, there's a trend in these pretentious restaurants to undercook foods today, which is ludicrous. Who started this is anyone's guess. It's part of this San Francisco snob culture that makes no sense whatsoever. I'm trained as an anthropologist as well as a botanist, okay? And one of the early studies, books or essays written on the subject was called The Raw and the Cook by Claude Lévi-Strauss, one of the great anthropologists of the last century. Claude Lévi-Strauss wrote that book, The Raw and the Cook, and he defined civilization as beginning when man learned to cook food, which is not to say that all raw foods are to be ignored or avoided. But you must understand that there's a limit to raw foods, and this whole trend of undercooking fish. I won't eat fish that's pink. More than likely, the fish contains microscopic parasites. It must be cooked all the way through. I do not eat steak tartare. You got to be insane to eat raw meat. Look what it did to France. So this whole idea of raw foods, raw enzyme, they don't even know what an enzyme is. The same people who tell you that gluten, I'm on a gluten-free diet, but they don't know what gluten is. They know it's bad for you. They know that global warming is caused by something or other that's bad. Evil Republicans cause global warming. Gluten causes them to be disturbed and fat. And cooking food ruins it. Yeah, gotta be like an animal, like a lion, just eat raw food. They don't know what they're talking about. It's ignorance and pretentiousness and stupidity. So be careful. I mean, you got to understand that there's neuroimmunology involved in this. Suicide is a critically important mental health issue, and it may be related to parasites in some cases. In this case, it's the parasite called T. gondii. T. gondii. You don't want to get it. You don't want to change cat litter. You don't want to have babies around cat litter. And that's common sense. I myself am a dog person. I never liked cats. Doesn't mean that I'm right or wrong, but I don't like them around. I wouldn't have them around my kids when they were babies. I remember there were studies even then that showed not a causal link, but a weak putative link between cats and childhood leukemia. And I became real skittish about it, and I wouldn't let my children be around cats. Now, whether there was any truth to it is irrelevant. What's relevant is that the cat litter boxes are disgusting to have in a house. They're disgusting. And every time you bend over to clean one of those things, you're taking a chance of losing your marbles. Now, it's true that dogs also carry communicable diseases, but there's hardly an article about that. But, yeah, all right. But the difference is dog feces are not kept in the house like a cat's are. Okay? Let's be clear here. Dog is overt. Cat is covert. That's how I define it. I like a dog because, there it is, he lifts his leg, it's over with. Cat's always hiding. Cat always hides their waist. Dog is right out there. I don't like, go right out, drop, and that's it. Go out with the dog, bingo. Cat always like looks at you, like sneaks away and does it. But look, if you lived in 1492 and you had a barn full of grain without which your family would have died, certainly you had cats around to keep the rats down. But what do you need one for now? What do you need a cat in the house for? I know I'm going to get cat callers. Now, that's not the point. I'm trying to warn you. The findings are published in the online in the Archives of General Psychiatry. T. gondii. Raw vegetables, insane. Humans can become infected by changing their infected cat's litter boxes, eating unwashed vegetables, drinking water, blah, blah, eating undercooked or raw meat, or not washing kitchen knives. My mother was fanatic. Every time she used an implement in the kitchen, it was like drenched in boiling water. She was right. Pregnant women can pass the parasite directly to their unborn babies and are advised not to change cat litter boxes to avoid possible infection. All right, we've covered that. Now let's move on to the Honda trying to cut me off in my V12 Mercedes. Well, what was she thinking? I mean, what was that crazed liberal thinking? I didn't do anything to bother her. I wasn't racing with her. I was on Bay Street coming to the radio station, minding my business, and she had a vendetta to pass me on. It didn't matter, right, left. She just wanted to prove that her little Honda was better than my big monster, you know, Wilhelm. I call him Wilhelm. I gave him a name. Wilhelm is now 4 years old. He's getting old. No matter how you try, you get like, I have a ding neurosis for my cars. Remember I told you about ding neurosis? I defined it. I'm like the guy who like parks his car on the other side of the parking lot, under a tree. Nevertheless, there are people who find you and ding you, no matter what you do. There's like invisible dings appear on my car. I don't know where they come from because I never park parallel next to anyone. My dream is to pull into like a parking lot and find a parallel spot under a tree. That's nirvana. That's as close to nirvana as I'm going to find. Parallel spots under a tree. Unbelievable. But then you always have the fear that some yokel with a pickup truck with a... You ever see the yokels with the pickup trucks, the big ones on the raised wheels, the guys who have absolutely no sense of manhood? They need a truck with the raised wheels with a trailer hook on the back of it. Because they could back into you and smash in your grill and pull away. You'd have no evidence. There's no paint on the trailer hook. That's your worst fear. Is you're going to park parallel and some yokel with one of those pickup trucks are going to bash your grill in just because you have a nicer car. So yeah, you can. But you get the nicks. You get the dings, the ding the roses, no matter what you do. But nevertheless, I wasn't bothering anybody. I'm driving, and she wants to pass. It's not like I wouldn't let her pass. It was crazy. Bay Street is a very narrow two-lane road. Sometimes cars coming out. You can't really pass. And everyone gets nervous. Someone's going to turn left to Fisherman's Wharf. So they try to, like, lap you on the right side. It's like Indianapolis 500. I wouldn't let her pass me. It was dangerous. So she went around me on the left in oncoming traffic, almost killed both of us. Right? Crazy woman. Mad woman. What am I going to say? Do I know who she was? No. She knew me? No. Okay. Make a generalization about her? Yes. Absolutely. If she was in a Prius with an Obama sticker, yes. But no, she was in a Honda. Honda's like old, so old-fashioned. Honda's like not even eating raw. I mean, the Prius is like eating, you know, raw and showing everyone how cool you are. But this whole raw food, undercooked food, is very much like people who bandy about certain dietary restrictions for their religious beliefs. This, oh, no, I don't touch that stuff. No, that's okay if you eat that garbage. That's fine. Eat it around me. No, it's fine. But people are saying you're an animal. No, I eat the shrimp. I don't care. No, I eat the garbage. Eat the treif. No, I don't touch the garbage myself. No, you can eat it on me. No, I just won't touch a thing in your house. Nothing. No, nothing. A special cooking. No, don't. No, you're perfectly fine. Don't take it the wrong way. I just won't touch it. That's all. Would you like a glass of water? No, unless you have a paper cup. Yeah. You have a paper cup? Maybe I'll have a water. A bottle of water, maybe. You have a bottle of water? Have you a bottle of water? I love people come to your house, you offer them something, they won't touch it. I don't like people like that. I don't trust them. I don't like people come to the house and say, would you like something? Not even a bottle. How about a beer? Soda? No. Juice? No. A bottle of water? No. No, no, no. Would it have like a disease? What do you mean you don't want a bottle of water? That's so rude. Is that rude or am I wrong? I once had a friend, I dropped him. He came to one of my parties 100 years ago, I don't know, 20 years ago, and he ate the food, but he brought his own water, a bottle of water, here in a restaurant. Like, they didn't have bottled water. He was so special, he needed bottled water. Watch out for people with, like, super allergies that are allergic to everything. A lot of them are using it as rackets to, like, get over on people. Yes? That's correct. And I'm someone, by the way, who suffers from, I don't like perfume, I don't like scents of any kind. I don't beat people up with it. I avoid them. That's all. The dog I like, he smells good. Generally, I'm allergic to people at this stage of my life. There's always something with some person, something about that person that bothers me. An off smell, an off sound, a breath I could faint from. Have you noticed that as you get older? Is that why people withdraw as they get older? There's something about everything about somebody, the way a tooth looks, you don't like it. Just something, you're talking to them, and things that you never noticed as a younger person, like the way their teeth are shaped, can bother you and set you. Because certainly like people's teeth can set you off, like the way one is too sharp, and you start getting like atavistic fears of the individual. Or let's say their fingernails are dirty, you don't trust them after that. There's certain things where they wear like a dirty tennis sneaker, you don't want to be around them. Let's not get too personal here, but that's why I can't go on a cruise ship. There's one leaving right now as I'm speaking here in San Francisco. I am changing. I used to look with such want. There's the white ship backing out of the harbor. The tugs are pushing it, going, There are the thousands of Eddies and Edettes standing with their cocktail in hand looking over the side of the ship. As San Francisco fades into the background, they go into the Golden Gate Bridge. And then what? Then what? 7 days of what? I don't understand it. I really don't know. When I was young, yeah, but I went on ships when they were not cruise lines. They were passenger liners. Nothing wrong with it. What are you going on a ship for? You have to climb a wall. Can anyone explain that to me?
They build a ship today. I'm astounded. What they build, the engineering is amazing. You're going on a ship to climb a rock wall? Why don't you stay home and climb a rock wall in a sporting goods store? You're going on a ship to see the sea. Why do you have to climb a rock wall? Or they build a ship with an ice skating rink on it. You ever hear anything like this? Why are you going on a ship? I don't understand it. I went on ships because I love the ocean. I love the water, the motion of the sea. Yes, it made me a superior person. Yes, it did. Yeah, absolutely made me a superior traveler, superior person, more intelligent than the people today. No question about it. This whole concept of rock climbing and ice skating on a cruise liner, I don't understand what they're going for. Stay home and go. Go to an ice skating rink. But to each his own. It's a big world, 6 billion people or whatever. And look how many voted for Obama. Take a look at the intelligence level. I had to throw that in just so you knew. Just so you didn't lose track of what show you were listening to.
Savage.
Listen, talk radio is primarily political. Let's start with that. However, I try to give you more than politics. I try to give you a versatile show, and many of you say, oh, Mike, we know where you stand politically. Tell us more stories about Teddy. Tell us. How much can I tell you about Teddy? So I'll tell you about Teddy. No, I don't have anything to tell you about Teddy. I'll tell you another story, just for the heck of it, since I need a breather myself. My head's spinning. Why? We had a family gathering, a mini family gathering over the last 3 days. Someone I love dearly came up, and you know how obsessed I am with food, right? I am like a starvation case compared to this individual who puts me to shame in terms of the obsession with food. We have been eating for 3 days straight. I've been giving food away to anyone I could find, bags of bagels, packages of smoked salmon. Chinese food was given away in trays. This is astounding. No one could believe the amounts of food that were ordered. I'm sick from it. I need to have my stomach pumped from the left. I mean, this weekend I'm going to basically spend in bed trying to purge the food we've been eating. I've never seen anything like this. You say, well, okay, what's so funny about that? Nothing. There's nothing funny about it. That's just the point. So what is this all about? The answer is, this is family. You get together over a meal. You break rice together. You argue for 3 days straight. What could be better? What could be better than to argue over the drop of a grain of rice? Nothing could be better than that. That's family life. You see, if you think that family life consists of a life with father and everyone gets together and it's you hold hands and you pray to the Lord and yes, Father, I love you and yes, Mother, may I help you and yes, Son, you're wonderful and yes, Daughter, you're great. Well, you don't know what real life 101 is because family life is strife life. Family life is strife life. And the faster you know that life is strife to begin with, the less trouble you're going to have with life. That's life 101. Anyone who tells you that you're supposed to have a smooth ride, life is not a bed of roses. Anyone who promises you that is sending you down the road of disappointment, frustration, and medication. The day you learn that life is strife, life is disagreement, life is arguing with people and coming to a conclusion without violence, then you're on the road to understanding what life really is. Life is struggle. That's all. It's as simple as that. So if this sounds like something you already heard, I can't help it. Sometimes the simplest things are the truest things. You understand that? Now let's get back to regular programming. How come you've tuned out of politics? How come you have tuned out of politics? Lou on WOR, you're next up. Go ahead, please.
Michael, I'm tuning out of politics because we are all being inundated by so much garbage from this administration on a daily basis that as a human being, you can only absorb so much of this crap. So I'm taking a step back, waiting for the election, and hopefully we're going to run this guy out on a rail in November.
So wait, so you're confirming what I suspect, which is you don't even want to hear what Obama does next because you wouldn't be shocked by it.
Not at all. I wouldn't be shocked by anything.
Okay, so you're saying I understand he's bad. I understand he's a devious guy who's out for as much power as he can get. They're corrupt. They're robbing the Treasury blind. What can I do about it? I have one chance. That's November. Until then, I don't even want to hear about it anymore. Is that basically what you're saying?
That's basically it, Michael. And as far as I can see, what this guy gets away with, he makes Al Capone blush in his grave, not turn over and do circles. He makes him blush.
No, I've never seen anything like this, and I've also never seen such a media cover-up.
like this. No. Never. Never. It's astounding. It's astounding.
These people, these journalists, they're an embarrassment, an absolute embarrassment. They're cheerleaders. Yeah,
no, no. The journalism schools were taken over 20 years ago by three different men. I know, I mean, I knew all three of them. I didn't know them personally. These were all hardcore radicals on the order of Reverend Wright. They run the New York, excuse me, they run the journalism schools in this country, and they handpick the stooges that are allowed to go through them and graduate so they can control them like puppets. So that's why we have a compliant press. But Lou, having said what you said, that there's too much corruption, you don't want to hear any more about Obama scandals, you know what he is. You know that he's basically trashed the White House and America. You know that he stabs us in the back at every turn. You know he laughs at us behind our back. You know all of this. What then would you tune into talk radio to hear till November?
Michael, you make my wife and I laugh. And you also, you know, you fill the airwaves with wisdom, whether it's quoting from the Bible, whether it's quoting from your personal life, whether it's the Italian guys that helped rescue you on the boat that time from the guy that was going to try to do something. I mean, it's one thing after the other, whether it's the other guy.
Oh, you remember that one little story when a guy got nasty and some Italian kid came over and threatened to beat him up for me?
Well, there were three guys. I think you said they were all from Brooklyn, and they approached.
Yeah, they were. I've never saw that guy again. I mean, we called each other, we emailed each other a few times. I never saw him again. He was a great guy. He said, he didn't even know me. I remember he came over. He said, "Hey, Mike, is this guy bothering you?" You should have seen the three of them run back into their sailboat, the smarty little liberals with their headbands.
Right, and I'll tell you, Michael, those are the guys. The wise man once said, "The world we grew up in is no longer here." That wise man is you, and those guys from Brooklyn, and my uncles that are no longer here. The colorful characters that I grew up with are no longer here. That's why I tune into you. You're my colorful uncle that I grew up with, Michael.
Well, Lou, I got to tell you, unfortunately, you make me a little nervous and sad when you say that. I know that's true. In many ways, I'm one of the last people standing from that generation, certainly in the media. You know, the time has gone by very fast, Lou. To me, I don't want to get maudlin right now, but 1994 is when I began in radio. I was already a man with three previous successful careers. I went into radio late in life. I never thought I would last this long, nor did I ever expect I'd still be here standing on Earth to begin with. And here I am standing strong as from the day I started, and I haven't really changed my politics, but when I see the media landscape and I realize that most of the other fellows, even on the conservative side, are like 20 years my junior, I realize that I'm in a very special position. You understand that, don't you?
I don't know what your listeners would do without you, Michael, to be honest. I mean, you're a breath of fresh air, your insight into things, your intellect, and I'm not just trying to butter you up. But
no, it's because I'm an older person who's lived a very full life so far. Unless you have a wife and children and a family and you have that, you really shouldn't even be in talk radio, to be frank with you. And I'm not knocking anyone in particular. Unless you have had children, you have no right talking about family values. Am I right or wrong about that?
Right about that, Michael. And by the way, we love your stories on Teddy, of course. We have three dogs of our own, and we love them.
Oh, this is great. Okay, my friend Lou, if you name it, you gain it. What's the book?
Trickle Down Poverty.
Okay, you get it anyway. It's very hard. The winner was Trickle Up Poverty. Now this is Trickle Down Tyranny, and I want everyone who bought the poverty book to buy the tyranny book.
Savage.
You know what I was doing during before the show started is I have a family friend that's flying right now. I love going on FlightAware.com. Like, I see that they're over Texas. They just had lunch. It's like a 6-hour, 5-hour, 21-minute flight. I like to see the fare. The fare, it says, you know what I'm doing? You go on Flight Tracker, you could follow, like, friends and relatives as they're flying across the country. It's the big Boeing 767 with a sleeper seat. I hear they're great. I've never been on one because either I don't travel at all or I travel in another manner altogether. If I could, I'd travel by private railroad coach. The problem is they don't go anywhere I want to go, and all the railroad stations are in the bad part of town.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Yeah.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Why should America still care about Israel? I could argue we should care more about Mexico than about Israel. Or we could argue that we should care more about El Salvador than about Israel, because I believe there are probably several million El Salvadorans here in the United States of America. So why doesn't Romney go to San Salvador and give a speech about the relationship between the two nations? Why doesn't he go to Mexico City and give a speech? It's an interesting question. And, I mean, there's only a few answers to that question. And one of them is that Israel faces an existential annihilation by Iran, who has said clearly over and over again they're going to wipe out all the Jews and wipe Israel off the map. That's what Ahmadinejad said. If we had a real UN that was worth anything, and I'm a real believer that we should eliminate the UN, we should leave it and throw them out of New York. I felt that a long time. They're nothing but a pack of you-know-whats. They hate this country. They stand for everything wrong in the world. If there was a legitimate United Nations, Ahmadinejad would have been arrested for crimes against humanity. But no, there's no UN, there's no, of no value whatsoever. Now, at the same time we're talking about this, and I'm going to take your calls here at 1-800-449-8255. Why should America care about Israel? I'd like your answer. My position, I don't even, if you know my position, nor do I think my position is that important, because I'm only one of hundreds of millions of Americans. I have a radio show, but it's only one vote, one man, one vote. So I have an opinion, and it may not be the one you think it is, but I'm asking you, why are we so obsessed with Israel? What is this all about? I think it's worth discussion. This is an amazing thing. The evangelical Christians are a better friend of Israel than our secular liberal Jews in the United States of America. Secular liberal Jews have almost no affinity for Israel. In my experience and estimation, secular liberal Jews who have no spine to begin with, and no sense of America, no sense of borders, language, or culture, certainly could care less about Israel or its survival. So the only friends that Israel really has in this country, amongst any large voting bloc, are amongst the evangelical Christians. Should we still care about Israel and why? And I'd like to know the answer. So I'll start with New York Elliot. A lot of New York calls, because apparently the biggest support for Israel is still found in New York City. New York, Elliot on WOR. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Savage, it's very simple. America needs Israel more than Israel needs America. Why? Because God judges the nations according to the way they treat the Jewish people entrusted to their care.
Wait a minute. We are our brother's keeper? You mean we have a lifetime liability to take care of Israel?
No, that's not what I said. I said that God judges the nations on how they treat the Jews entrusted to their care.
Wait a minute. Let's slow down. What about all the Russian gangsters that have moved into Israel? We should take care of them, too?
Again, listen, I'm just giving you a broad overview.
I'm giving you a non-broad overview. I'm asking a question. What are they, all sterling characters in Israel? Everyone in Israel is a sacred holy man.
I'm telling you that throughout...
Israel's a corrupt Mediterranean nation, okay? Let's be clear. Ask an Israeli and see if I'm lying. Israel is a corrupt Mediterranean nation, albeit it's the best friend we have in the Middle East, but we really need them, or do they need us?
Savage, take a look at history. The Spanish Empire, they screwed the Jews, they lost their empire. The British turned on the Jews, they lost their empire.
So you really think that it's God's will?
Listen, I'm a religious guy. This is one man's opinion. This is my opinion. If you watch, if America dumps the Jews, you'll see how fast America is going to be gone from the world scene. America is the new Rome. Let's see, you know, if they're going to be...
Well, that's a pretty powerful statement, Elliot, to believe that our future hinges upon the tail. I mean... After all, Israel's not the dog, it's the tail. We're wagging Israel.
Have it backwards, Savage. Israel is not the tail. That's the problem. You're looking at it backwards.
So wait a minute. If Israel's the holy land and the promised land, why do you live in the tail, not the dog?
Because right now we're still in the diaspora. We're waiting for the Messiah to come.
And when the Messiah comes, you're going to move where? To Jerusalem or Tel Aviv?
No, not necessarily. When the Messiah comes, you'll still be able to live wherever you want, but it'll be a different, it'll be a new world.
And who is the Messiah?
I don't know if I knew that.
Well, no, I last I got a laugh out of you. I didn't know who I thought I had a real fanatic on the phone.
I'm at least
I got a chuckle out of you. I got frightened for a minute. I thought I had a nut here.
I'm not a Bible thumper. I'm not a fanatic. I'm just telling this is one man's opinion. That's the way I view the world.
I'm not saying that I disagree historically in what you said, but I don't know that you can tie the abandonment of Israel to the fall of the nation.
Well, that's the way that you, that's the Jewish way of looking at the world.
Yeah, but that's kind of ethnocentric, isn't it?
Ethnocentric. Again, it's not.
It's very ethnocentric. Do you think that somebody from Kansas thinks of that in the same way? Someone from Kansas whose son is in the military thinks about Israel the way you do?
Yes. I'll tell you why. About 35 years ago, I used to travel all around the country. I was a traveling salesman, and I had a beard, and I used to go around. I had a suit and a hat, and I was in Kansas, and I was in Omaha, and I was in all these crummy places. And let me tell you, I would go into a store, and they used to be, you know, they used to treat me so grandly because they believed that by being nice to me, that God was going to bless them.
Did you sell a suit, a kite, and a gabardine?
I mean, no. I mean, like, I had a... But, no, I mean, not like a satin, but, I mean, I had, like, a conservative suit with a beard and a
hat. All right. I don't know if you're pulling my leg. I don't know who that is. It sounds like Howard Stern on Laughing Gas. Who was that? Howard Stern on Laughing Gas? Was that Glenn Beck with a sweater over his face? That wasn't a guy. Come on. It was a good call. He had me on the run for a while. It sounded like Glenn Beck looking, because Glenn Beck's ego is so big right now. You know what I don't understand about Glenn Beck, as a side note? How could someone who's a high school dropout run a university, the Glenn Beck University? Can anyone explain that to me? Can a high school dropout run a university? I guess in America, anything is possible. In America, the streets are paved with yolds, not with gold. Here's what I got to do, my job. You're listening to the Savage Nation, right? I got to think, what are you going to be interested in talking about? I mean, I could have talked about a lot of other things. I could have brought up any topic under the sun. It's a valid topic, which is, do Americans still care about Israel? I'm not so sure the young ones do, for example. I don't think the young ones care about anything except what app they're going to get. That's it. Everything in their mind is an app. They're like brain-dead zombies. They're brain-dead, drug-addicted, sex-addicted zombies, the young ones. Which is why they're the natural constituency of Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama. And they know it, too. Believe me, they know it. You think they care about Israel? They have no ties to Israel. No feelings for it. And so it's a different world that's emerged. You know, you could say one thing, but the world is bigger than what we think. I'm older than most people listening to the show. So I have one set of opinions. Hopefully that the opinions that I have, or the viewpoints I have, to put it that way, still resonate with a good portion of America. I assume that my viewpoints are not that bizarre, but the young people don't have the same viewpoints I do. They're fundamentally sort of from the Brave New World model. The young people in this country are in, by and large, I'm trying to pick the correct word. I would say asocial. No, that's not the word. Well, you could say that because they grew up with apps, with phones and devices. They have a lot of trouble talking to people. And you could say they're somewhat asocial. I would say they're apolitical more than anything else. They don't even care about politics. They're brainwashed. They believe global warming is a religious truth. They don't even, you know, it's an interesting thing on global warming. It'll take me a minute to explain something. A new guy comes up from Berkeley, another professor who was a so-called skeptic, pops up and says, "I'm no longer a skeptic. Now I'm sure that global warming is caused by man." And so, what did he just prove? As a trained scientist, what he proved is that it's debatable. In other words, if the biggest skeptics now suddenly became a believer, it proves that the whole field is in flux. That's how science works. But go explain that to idiots who don't even understand the basic premise of science, which is that of experimentation and proof. So in other words, if the leading skeptic suddenly becomes a believer in global warming, all he did was prove that it's debatable. That's all. It's the end of the discussion. I could wipe the floor with him tomorrow. Don't tell me every scientist believes that it's caused by mankind, because it's not true. I can show you those doing studies of ice cores in the Antarctic and the Arctic, which will prove that global warming is not a new phenomenon. So this schmuck from Berkeley probably was told in plain English, look, idiot, your grant's not being renewed. We're not funding any more skepticism. Under the Obama regime, you're not getting another dime. So I'll tell you what, if you convert now to the believing school, oh boy, wait till you see what we throw at you. But all he's proven in a nutshell is that it's a debatable discussion, debatable issue. See it? But do you understand what I just said? Yes, you may if you know how to reason. But I would say most young people don't even follow the line of reasoning I just presented to you. They can't even understand what I just said.
Savage.
Do you still support Israel? Should we carry Israel on our back? And why? Because we do carry Israel on our back. We're still giving $4-5 billion a year to Israel and the same amount to the Islamists in Egypt. Can you figure this out? How long do you think it's going to be before the Islamists really show their fangs? How long do you think it's going to be till when Hillary Clinton says, I'm shocked. They told us that they were going to be moderate. I'm shocked that they burnt down another 30 churches and drove out another 30,000 Christians. I'm stunned. Because our doxy, as put forward by the group that I represent, says Hillary Clinton, our doxy is that the Islamists are good people. It's unbelievable to me. So anyway, let's go back to Israel. What do we need them for, in plain English? Ryan in New York on WOR, your opinion counts. Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, unlike the last caller, absolutely, Israel needs us a lot more than we need them. However, unlike Mexico and El Salvador, we depend on them a lot for our security and our intelligence, and therefore I do feel it is imperative to continue supporting Israel.
Okay, Although, hold on, wait. I want to follow you. I want to listen carefully, which I've done. How do we depend upon Israel for our security when in the first Gulf War they were told to stand down and not fire a shot, and they were hiding underneath our shields?
I understand that, but...
In the first Gulf War, their boys didn't come home in body bags. Ours did.
No, you are...
How do you explain we need them? We need them for what?
However, a lot has changed in the world since then, and the whole wave now, what's going on in the Middle East, especially the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood and all the intelligence that yes. Israel does provide us, I feel would help us in the long run.
I'm not so sure. I think with Hillary Clinton and George Soros and Jimmy Carter and Zbigniew Brzezinski and Obama and that pack of anti-Semites that I just named, by the way, and I know one of them at least is Jewish, but that doesn't mean they're not anti-Israel and anti-Semitic. You know, it's not an oxymoron to say that. But I don't want to go into the subtleties of what I just said. With that pack of anti-Semites ruling the world right now, okay, it's not really inconceivable that Israel could face an existential threat of being annihilated by a nuclear weapon. That's all because they overthrew our greatest ally in Egypt, a man who had been at peace with Israel for 40-some-odd years, and they killed him. They killed Mubarak. They threw him overboard, and they let the outlawed band Muslim Brotherhood come to power, and they're going to do the same thing in Syria. You're telling me Israel's not facing a greater threat now than it did 30 years ago? I would say it is.
Absolutely.
So they need us more than we need them, right?
Oh, that's for sure. But I do say that they will contribute, unlike Mexico and El Salvador.
To what? What will they? Well, hold on now. So our national interest in the Middle East, let's put aside spiritual, religious. What are our national interests in the Middle East? There's only one answer. Oil, correct?
Correct. I mean, obviously everything comes down to money.
Now, wait, hold on now. This is an interesting thing to follow. Oil, oil, oil. Oil, oil, oil. But Obama blocks the Keystone XL pipeline, which would have brought oil from Canada to America. Why would Obama block a flow of oil and increase our dependency upon the Arabs? Why would he do that?
Well, absolutely. I mean,
you know, to me, this is basic. This is 101. Obama is the greatest national security threat that I've seen in my lifetime. Canada wants to pump, I don't know how many hundreds of millions of barrels of oil to us on a safe, secure pipeline, no ships required, would lower the price of oil, reduces our dependency upon the Arabs, and Obama blocks it. So Canada's going to send it instead to Vancouver and transship it to China. Now, why would Obama do it? There's only three reasons. One, he's in bed with the Islamists. Two, he's in bed with the fake solar gangsters who are making trillions of dollars on false solar contracts and want to make certain that we have a greater dependency upon solar than upon oil, which is one of the greatest scams of our lifetime. And three, there's a wild card that I can't figure out yet. But nevertheless, I'm gonna blow the lid off this seething nightmare, which is that ultra-liberal Jews. I'm going to pick an example of the type I'm talking about so you have an image. An image would be that of, let us say, that comedian, a Woody Allen type, for example. Ultra-liberal, so-called progressive world citizen. That type of man detests and fears, in my opinion, detests and fears evangelical Christians. And I've heard them say to me, you know why the evangelical loves Jews in Israel? Why? Because they believe that after the coming of Jesus, the second coming of Jesus, all the Jews will convert to Christianity. So we shouldn't trust the evangelicals. They have such circuitous reasoning that at the end of the day is nothing but racism.
Well, actually, that's a true statement.
No, I know it's a true statement, but in the interim, Israel's here and needs all the support it can get. It doesn't mean you're forcibly going to convert all the Jews to Christianity?
No, and we believe that the Messiah will take care of that.
So, all right, you ought to tell that to Larry David, because I think Larry David thinks you're actually going to force Jews to be baptized. So now I'm going to open it up to another line of questioning on the Savage Nation. You have now entered the Savage Court, so here's the other side. You're a secular, non-religious Jewish person. You consider yourself culturally Jewish, but you have no religious feelings. You believe the evangelical is evil, even though they are the greatest supporter of Israel.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Why do you have such contempt for the evangelical? Isn't it racist of you to have such suspicion of Christians who support Israel? I would think it's very, very racist of you. But I don't think I'm going to get a Larry David-like caller on this show. I don't believe they listen to the show, number one. And number two, I don't think they call. So I'm eating a radio meal during the show. It is appropriately in a styrofoam container with an aluminum cap from a local chicken joint. But it's got almost no chicken in it, which is, I know it's healthy. And they're ripping me off. I had it brought in. I know it's very, very healthy because there's no chicken in it. It's, they tell you, they give you, but the longer the story on the list of how good it is for you, the less chicken. There's little shards of chicken, beans, or cut up mango, God knows what. I'm so hungry, even I'm eating it, and it's not, but, yeah, the less story, the more the meat. It's like a quotient. The less of a write-up on the wall about sustainable this, sustainable. The more you read about green and sustainable, the less food you're getting. And the more you're getting, you know what. Did I tell you why I didn't move to Israel in 1979? Raise your hand in the audience if you want to hear the story. I told it maybe once. Oh, I don't want to tell it. I didn't want to tease you. Another day, I'm not in the mood. What else is there to talk about? Bad chicken, good chicken, bad tie, good tie, Obama win. Why do you think Romney's jumping through 20-point lead amongst white voters? I don't think it's a tough question. Could it be because Obama has basically turned his back on white voters the way he's turned his back on Israel? Hello, anybody out there? Do you think Obama really appeals to blue-collar Democrats? I don't. I don't know why any blue-collar Democrat would ever vote for, a blue-collar worker would vote for Obama unless he's a cop or a fireman. Then I could see why 90% of cops and firemen, although they may have a flag on their motorcycle, they're going to vote Democrat for the pension. Period. End of story. Don't look to a cop to have a discussion about politics. Their unions go Democrat for the pensions. That's all. You expect the fireman to vote for Romney? You expect the cop to vote for Romney? You'll find a few here and there. It's like Jewish people. 1 out of 10 might vote for Romney. You'll find a 10%er. Here was Nancy Pelosi insulting all Jews, saying they're only interested in tax breaks. Listen.
Many of the Republicans are using Israel as an excuse. Mm. What they really want are tax cuts for the wealthy. Mm. So Israel, that can be one reason they
put
forth.
That's why some of the Republican Jewish supporters are really active.
Well, that's how they're being exploited.
Right.
And they're smart people. They found these issues. Right.
They're smart people. Them Jews are smart, Nancy, huh? Them Jews, you know, they're smart people, but, oh, but they only want a tax break. Is that it, Nancy? What if Republicans said those black people are real smart, but they're being exploited? And they're smart people. How would that play in America? That's from a former Speaker of the House. Governor Corleone. Senator Corleone. I watched that movie last night. My mind just jumped to it for some reason. I don't know why. I love that scene where Brando dies in the grape vineyard, in the tomato vineyard with his grandson. What a piece of acting, directing. That's when Coppola was great. I watched that scene last night on HD. Remember when he falls over chasing the kid with the orange peel in his mouth and they're shooting with the insecticide can? It was one of the greatest cinematic scenes ever made. Unbelievable. And Brando, no one ever topped him in some ways. When he dies of the heart attack and he falls over and grabs the stakes that hold up the tomato plants, it's like you're feeling the death of a whole generation. I mean, Coppola had the greatest eye of his time. There's no question about it. When he fell over, Brando, in the tomato patch and held on to the tomato stakes, it was like he was trying to hold on to his tradition, hold on to his time on Earth, and he goes over, and the next scene is the little boy laughing, and then the white cloth over the tomatoes flapping. I've never seen a more perfectly done scene. It's amongst one of the greatest scenes ever done. And, you know, it came around a time when my father died. It really struck me. I looked at it again last night. My father died right around that time, and it was really profound in my life. I think it shaped my life in ways I don't even want to admit. Movies do shape our lives, which goes right back to the evil vermin who run Hollywood today. They should be held up on crimes against humanity. That's right. That's right. If we had a legitimate government that was not put in power by the moguls of Hollywood, the Caesars of our time, they'd be held up on crimes against humanity for what they've done to this country and the world. But, all right, forget about it. All right, play the Brando clip. I'll have a bite of the bad chicken. Play it.
I don't apologize. That's my life. But I thought that when it was your time that you would be the one to hold the strings. Senator Corleone. Governor Corleone. Something.
I'm not a Pezzanovanta.
This wasn't enough time, Michael. Wasn't enough time.
We'll get there, Pop.
Well, they got there now. That was a long time ago, 1970. There's been plenty of time, right? 70, 80, tick-tock. 70 to 89. It's only 40 years. Another generation. Look how good we're doing as a result, huh? Isn't that great? The sporting goods store has been emptied out. They're selling off the credit out of the back of the store. They sold off the gloves, the bowling shoes, the bowling pins. All that's left is the shell. The shell of America is all that's left. That's how good it's been. And we don't know. We don't know nothing, no. No. We don't know why it happened, how it happened. We know from nothing. Never saw such criminality in my life. And Romney won't touch it. And there's a reason. And the reason is because the Republicans are as big a thief, bigger thieves, a band of thieves like I never saw during the Iraq war. Look what Halliburton, look what Cheney, right, Cakey, Colbert. Look, take a look at what they made, Halliburton, on the war. You thought it was about the flag that Sean Hannity displayed on Fox News? And all of the Blarney events that O'Reilly ran with the flag in the background liberating Iraqis. Are you crazy? Don't be stupid. It was all about money. It's always been about money.
Savage.
We're still talking about Israel. No one will drop that topic. So I'll take some callers on the Israel. New York, Mark, you've been holding a long time. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Your premise that the U.S. is carrying Israel is a false premise, with all due respect. The United States contributes just a couple of billion dollars a year to Israel in military aid, which is roughly 1% of Israel's GDP. Israel is one of the richest countries in the world, has about a $200 billion economy, the 40th largest economy in the world, and it is not carrying Israel. I might add that 75% of the military aid that Israel receives.
Let me finish your sentence because you're right. 70% of the $5 billion comes back to American defense manufacturers, correct?
Yes, but it's $2 billion, not five. About $35 billion a year in U.S. foreign aid goes to the Arab and Muslim countries. About two-thirds of U.S. foreign aid goes to the Arab and Muslim countries.
Well, it's a bigger question of why are we still giving foreign aid when we ourselves need foreign aid?
Well, it's military aid, but I would add that...
Why should we be providing military aid to Arab countries? Can you explain that to me?
There's no justification for that. I agree with you. But I would add that Israel is about the 20th largest U.S. export market. Israelis purchase upwards of $15 billion a year in American products. Israel is about the size of New Jersey, okay? It purchases more American products than India, which has a population of about a billion. So you can make the case that Israelis are offsetting any U.S. foreign aid merely by their purchases of American products.
It's a very, very intelligent conversation. You have your facts and figures, and I agree with every one of them.
Can I make one more point?
Please do.
You made a remark that was very hurtful because you said that Israelis have never participated in an American war. And
No, I didn't say that. I said in the first Gulf War they stood down. They were told to stand down.
Exactly.
And they hid under the American umbrella.
That's incorrect. The IDF was champing at the bit to get involved.
Well, I know that, but they weren't allowed to.
Exactly, and it has become U.S. military.
Wait, hold it.
Doctrine.
Now you're not saying what you intended to say, or if you intended to make me sound foolish, you didn't succeed, because I didn't say the Israelis didn't want to fight. I said they didn't participate, which is a fact.
Exactly.
But I know why they didn't participate.
Because we
told them not to, because we were afraid of exciting the Arab world.
You're absolutely correct, but you made it appear as though the Israelis have not wanted to contribute to American military successes. And, you know, it's...
Well, no, I didn't mean to imply that.
Okay.
But let me ask you, Israel just ended a draft exemption for the ultra-Orthodox. How do you feel about that?
I'm opposed to it.
Why?
Because I feel I'm a dual citizen. I'm an American citizen as well as an Israeli citizen. And I feel that every American and every Israeli should be involved in the military.
No. Israel ended a draft exemption for ultra-Orthodox, meaning you're in favor of that happening.
I'm absolutely in favor.
You want the ultra-Orthodox to stop hiding behind the Torah and serve, is what
you're
saying.
The ultra-Orthodox are very small. You know, Israel is a secular country, ironically, and the ultra-Orthodox are a very, very small percentage. But can I just make one final point?
This is a very important story, by the way, because there's hundreds of thousands, apparently, who don't serve in Israel because they're hiding behind the Orthodox rubric. And this is a decades-long draft exemption.
Well, Muhammad Ali was
originally written to preserve Jewish scholars, but it was never meant to protect the ultra-Orthodox from serving in the military.
Well, Americans are allowed religious exemptions. Cassius Clay was famous for not fighting in the war. So.
But he went to jail.
I'm not sure if he did or not.
Well, let's put it this way. Do you know that the ultra-Orthodox are saying they'd rather go to jail and comply with an end to the draft exemptions? Why would they rather go to jail and serve in the military? Would the ultra-Orthodox survive a day if it wasn't for the Jewish boys who were in the military?
It's not. They would not, of course not, but they are a little bit mishugana, as you say. There is an Orthodox sect that does not believe in the state of Israel. So there are some kooky religious sects in Israel, and I'm glad that they are not going to be exempted from war. But I wanted to
be honest with you, I think it's going to cause havoc in the Israeli military once they bring these kids in, who, by the way, study only religious books. They don't study science. They don't study anything but the religious books. How are they ever going to fit into the military in Israel?
Well,
nobody has an answer.
That remains to be seen.
I don't even know if the military... By the way, and thank you for calling. The people in Israel are glad that the ultra-Orthodox are no longer going to be exempt from the military. But the Israeli commanders, by what I read, don't even want them. They're not too sure they're going to be an asset to the military. They don't know how they can even train them, by the way. So it's a phenomenal story. The defense minister today, Ehud Barak, ordered the army to prepare for a universal draft of ultra-Orthodox Jewish men. I don't know what's going to happen to Israel. When Barak, Ehud Barak, not Barack Obama, when Ehud Barak, he was a great war man, a great military man, by the way. Very brave man. He was one of the men, Barak. I think he's a terrible politician, incidentally. But Barak was one of the Israeli men. You see the movie Munich, which was one of Spielberg's better movies, where a group of Israelis disguised themselves as Arab women in burqas and then opened up on the enemy with machine guns. It was phenomenally well done. Barak led that. So the guy's very brave, and he's fabulous as a military guy, not so great as a politician. When Barak, Ehud, and Netanyahu Benjamin are no longer leading Israel, I don't know how that country is going to survive, to be honest with you. They're the last of the old world, the last of the Mohicans, so to speak. So can we move on? Oh, here's a caller. I love this call because I don't understand it. Meir in New York is saying the ultra-Orthodox should not serve, and I'd like to know why. Meir, thanks for calling. Explain to this audience why.
Because it's not that the ultra-Orthodox wouldn't survive without the military. The military would not survive without Torah in Israel. We are there because God gave it to us, that we should do the Torah and the mitzvahs. If that's not kept and not practiced, we will never...
But why do so many Israelis, why are they so resentful of the ultra-Orthodox who don't serve?
Because they want to be, Israel as a country, but they don't want to be Jewish. They don't even know really why they're there. Why is that their country? Why are we in Israel?
But why can't the ultra-Orthodox serve in the military and be religious? Why are they mutually exclusive phenomena?
Because there's a lot of contradicting things in the military that an ultra-Orthodox Jew cannot be ultra-Orthodox in the military.
But I've seen pictures over the years of, there was a former chief rabbi of Israel 20 years ago who was a paratrooper and a great warrior. He was an Orthodox Jew, jumped out of airplanes with an Uzi. How did he do that?
Could be he did it, but the main thing has to be the security for Israel is Torah and nothing else.
You're not telling me that the Torah will protect Israel, not weapons and not the ability to defend themselves. I don't believe a word of that. What good did the Torah do all the Jews that were thrown into the ovens in Treblinka and Auschwitz and all of the other horrendous death camps? Did the Torah help them?
Question on that. We don't question God why he did that to us.
Well, maybe you should.
I never will question God. That's what he wanted. He warned us if we won't be good, we won't obey the Torah and mitzvahs, we will be persecuted, yes.
That's a phenomenal act of Meir. You know, I'm not one to mock anyone's faith, but that to me is absurd. I think if the Jewish people learn nothing from the Holocaust, it was that, yes, you should have one eye on the heavens and one eye on a machine gun, or else you're not going to survive very long.
We will survive. We were persecuted for thousands of years, and we're still here.
Yeah, well, you're still here, but you're not carrying your own weight in that regard. You see, the Israelis would say their sons are the ones going on the front lines, not your sons, and they want to know why not. That's what they're saying.
So look in history. Who are the Jewish people that carried on, that made us survive? Only the Torah Jews. Without the Torah Jews, we would have never survived. That's a fact in history.
But Meir, I am not suggesting that the Torah is something to ignore. It is something to revere and something to follow. But why, according to my reading, and tell me if I'm incorrect, According to my reading of the great sages of the Jewish tradition, I have read that a man who wants to be spiritually superior should divide his, should have a regular job in addition to studying Torah. He should have a trade, for example, and study Torah. Why must he be a pure scholar? How many pure scholars does the world need?
You're right that everybody has to have a trade plus the Torah, but anybody that chooses...
No, let's be real. How many of the guys down in the Diamond Center are Orthodox? There's an awful lot in that industry, correct?
But they learn Torah as well. But any Jew...
All right, wait. If so, then hold it now. So if they can study Torah, live Torah, be Orthodox, and be a diamond merchant, by the same token, they could also carry a gun and defend their nation.
True, right. But that's if somebody chooses to do this. But if you choose to sit and learn Torah, that's what you have to do. That's what.
Yeah, but wait, who's going to pay for the Torah study? Who's supposed to pay for it?
Who's supposed to pay? According to the Torah, the people that work, the people that have the money, have to and are obligated to support those.
You see, but this becomes the problem, Meir. This is the problem. Many people would like to sit and study Torah and not go to work or to defend their wives and children. They'd love to sit home and study the Bible or the Torah and not have to defend themselves. But I don't think that's flying in this generation in Israel, Meir. But again, I respect your viewpoint. Don't take any offense at what I said.
Savage.